Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. In this episode, I'm going to talk about Cooper v. Harris, a case about the redrawing of two congressional districts in North Carolina following the 2010 census. In the past 3 weeks, the court has decided 11 cases, but only one resulted in a sharply divided court, with the justices split 5-3 on the legality of one of the two challenged election districts. But what is this case all about? Cooper v. Harris was brought by individual voters challenging two congressional districts as impermissible racial gerrymanders. Gerrymandering is the process of manipulating the shape of electoral districts in order to favor a particular politician or political party. Although gerrymandering is a common practice that in the U.S. dates back to the very first congressional election, racial gerrymandering, that is, drawing district lines by allocating voters according to their race, can violate the constitutional right to equal protection of the laws. There's a catch, though. Sometimes legislators are required to take race into account when drawing districts. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, or VRA, enacted in 1965 and amended in 1982, bars any voting standard practice or procedure that results in members of a racial group having, quote, less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice. This provision has been interpreted to prohibit redistricting that effectively denies a minority racial group the opportunity to elect, quote, representatives of their choice, which is referred to as vote dilution. So, in order to avoid violating the VRA, legislators need to look at the racial composition of districts and racial voting patterns to determine what effect a proposed change would have on racial minorities. With that background in mind, let's look at this specific case. At issue were two districts, District 1 and District 12, which, before the redistricting, were about 48.6% and 43.8% African American, respectively. After the redistricting, additional black voters were added to each district, bringing the black voting age population up to 52.7% and 50.7%, respectively. Both districts were challenged as impermissible racial gerrymanders by North Carolina's Republican-dominated legislature. So why would Republicans want to increase the percentage of black voters in these districts, and why would Democrats care? The key is a concept called packing. By increasing the concentration of certain voters in one district, the concentration of those voters in other districts is reduced. Consider this simplified example. Imagine a state with two congressional districts where 60% of the voting population are registered Democrats and the other 40% are Republicans. If Democrats and Republicans are evenly distributed between the districts, then the Democrats have a strong 60-40 majority in both. But imagine instead that most of the Democrats could be packed into a single 100% Democratic district. This would leave the other district with a decisive 80-20 Republican advantage. That's the significance of packing. Of course, in the real world, the numbers won't be so extreme, but the logic is the same and applies equally to any population with distinctive voting patterns, like black voters in North Carolina. The courts examine allegations of racial gerrymandering under a two-part test. First, they ask whether race was the predominant reason for the drawing of district lines. And second, if race did predominate, was its use narrowly tailored to serve a compelling interest? This test played out differently in the two districts at issue. First, in District 1, North Carolina conceded that a deliberate decision had been made to increase the black voting population in order to create a majority black district. So under the first part of the racial gerrymandering test, race did predominate in drawing district lines. That brings us to the second part of the test. Did North Carolina have a compelling reason to create a majority black district? The state said it did this in order to comply with the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court has held that compliance with the VRA is a compelling reason to rely on race in drawing districts. So the question here is, did North Carolina need to create a majority black district in order to avoid vote dilution under the VRA? To answer this question, the court looked at the standard for a VRA vote dilution claim that it established in a 1986 case called Thornton v. Jingles. In that case, the court set out three conditions that must be shown for a vote dilution claim. First, there must be a minority group that could constitute a majority in some reasonably drawn legislative district. Second, the minority group must be politically cohesive, meaning that members of the group tend to vote for the same candidates. And third, the non-minority population must vote in a way that usually defeats the minority's preferred candidate. If these three conditions were met in District 1, then whether the district had a black majority could be the difference between the black population electing its preferred candidate and having no effective representation at all. The problem here, though, is that the third criterion, a white majority that regularly votes against the preferences of the black population, just doesn't exist in District 1. In fact, for two decades, the black population's preferred candidates consistently won elections with 60-70% of the vote, despite the black voters making up only 46-48% of the district. In District 1, black voters were not being denied the opportunity to elect their candidates of choice, so there could be no vote dilution claim under the VRA. Without any plausible risk of vote dilution, North Carolina's rationale for redrawing the district to make it majority black evaporates, and the court holds that this was an impermissible racial gerrymander. The court was unanimous with respect to this holding on District 1. District 12, however, is a different story. There, unlike with District 1, North Carolina denied deliberately using race to shape the district. So the key dispute is over the factual question of whether race in fact predominated in drawing the district. In the redistricting after the 2010 census, District 12 was reshaped in such a way that it gained 35,000 new black voters while losing 50,000 white voters. The complication here is the strong correlation between race and partisan affiliation. While the plaintiffs alleged that voters were specifically targeted on the basis of race, North Carolina argued that, in fact, it was manipulating district lines on the basis of partisan affiliation. In other words, legislators were trying to pack the district, but with Democrats, not black voters. Perhaps surprisingly, gerrymandering for purely partisan advantage is not unconstitutional. Here, there was strong disagreement between the court's majority opinion, written by Justice Kagan, and the partial dissent written by Justice Alito and joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy. Kagan and Alito dueled over what the facts showed with respect to racial versus political motives in redistricting, but they also fought over the correct standard of proof that should apply in such cases. The three-judge district court from which this case was appealed found that race predominated in the drawing of District 12, citing various statements and testimony from state legislators and the expert who drew the new districts as evidence of the predominant role race played in the redistricting process. Kagan's majority opinion repeatedly emphasizes the deference the Supreme Court gives to the district court with respect to factual determinations, particularly where that fact-finding involves assessing the credibility of live witnesses. The majority opinion walks through various pieces of evidence relied upon by the district court, which the majority finds sufficient to support the district court's finding of racial predominance. Alito's dissent, on the other hand, challenges the district court's evidence, examining individual statements and bits of testimony and arguing that they were taken out of context by the district court and construed to reflect on North Carolina in the most negative way. Ultimately, there's a fundamental disagreement between Justice Alito and the district court on how to interpret evidence of the legislators' motives in drawing District 12. But that disagreement plays out in an argument over how much deference should be given to the district court's factual findings. Alito also faults the majority for not requiring the plaintiffs to provide an alternate plan for redistricting. Alito cites the court's 2001 case, Easley v. Cromartie, usually referred to as Cromartie 2, where the court overturned a district court's finding of racial predominance in gerrymandering. In Cromartie 2, the court said that, quote, "the party attacking the legislatively drawn boundaries must show at the least that the legislature could have achieved its legitimate political objectives in alternative ways that are comparably consistent with traditional districting principles." The existence of an alternative map that achieves the sought-after political objectives without the complaint of racial effects provides some evidence that racial motives were in fact in play. On the other hand, if plaintiffs are unable to provide an alternate map without the same racial impact, that lends credence to claims that the redistricting was the result of legitimate political motives. In response to Alito's argument, the majority characterized Cromartie II's alternate map requirement as only applicable to cases where, quote, "plaintiffs had meager direct evidence of a racial gerrymander and needed to rely on evidence of foregone alternatives." In this case, the majority said, direct evidence of improper racial motives made a map irrelevant. Justice Kagan's majority opinion was joined by the other three justices making up the court's so-called liberal wing, Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor, but was also joined by Justice Thomas, one of the most consistently conservative voices on the court. Thomas fully joined the majority opinion, but also wrote a separate concurrence explaining his own views. First, with respect to District 1, although Thomas agreed with the court that North Carolina did not have valid vote dilution concerns under the Voting Rights Act that could justify creating a majority black district, Thomas would go much further, citing his previously expressed view that Section 2 of the VRA doesn't actually apply to redistricting and thus can never be invoked to rescue an otherwise impermissible race-based redistricting. Since the death of Justice Scalia, Thomas appears to be the only member of the court holding this view. With respect to District 12, Thomas agreed with the majority's deference to the district court and specifically cited his own 2001 dissent in Cromartie 2, where he similarly argued for deference to the district court's finding that race predominated. It's worth taking a moment to look at Cromartie 2. Cromartie 2 was a racial gerrymandering challenge to the 1997 redrawing of North Carolina's Congressional District 12, the exact same district at issue in Cooper v. Harris. And just like in Cooper v. Harris, the district court, after hearing expert testimony, found that race had predominated in drawing the district lines. The outcome at the Supreme Court, however, was different. In Cromartie 2, the court majority undertook what it described as an extensive review of the district court's factual findings, which included a critical examination of the testimony relied upon by the district court. Although the court conceded that there was, quote, a modicum of evidence offering support for the district court's conclusion, the court ultimately concluded that the district court's conclusions were clearly erroneous. The Cromartie 2 dissent, written by Justice Thomas, didn't take a position on the best interpretation of the evidence, but argued only that the district court's evaluation of the evidence was permissible and accused the majority of failing to give proper deference to the district court's fact-finding. The dissent also rejected a requirement for challengers to show an alternative redistricting plan in order to prevail on a racial gerrymandering claim. In other words, with respect to both the issue of deference to the district court's factual findings and the need for challengers to show a districting alternative, the majority in dissent appear to have flipped completely between Cromartie 2 and Cooper v. Harris. It's not at all surprising that the majority position of the court might shift in the 16 years between Cromartie 2 and Cooper v. Harris, especially given that the Cromartie 2 decision was divided 5-4. What is somewhat surprising is the lineup of justices in the two cases. In Cromartie 2, the majority was made up of Justice O'Connor, then considered the swing vote between the court's liberal and conservative wings, along with the four more liberal justices, including Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, who wrote the opinion. The dissent, written by Justice Thomas, was joined by the rest of the court's conservative justices, including Justice Kennedy. Of the four justices on the Cromartie 2 court who are still on the court today, three of them, Breyer, Ginsburg, and Kennedy, appear to have switched places with respect to the key legal issues. Only Justice Thomas came out in the same place in both cases. Of course, Cromartie 2 and Cooper v. Harris are different cases concerning a different redistricting with different testimony from different witnesses. There's no reason someone sifting through the facts and evaluating legislators' motives would necessarily come to the same conclusion in both cases. But on the high-level legal determinations underlying the Supreme Court's decisions, the amount of deference that the district court's fact-finding must be given and the type of evidence challengers must put forward, it's very difficult to reconcile the respective majorities and dissents in Cromartie 2 and Cooper v. Harris. Litigation over various iterations of North Carolina's District 12 has been going on for more than two decades, with no fewer than five separate appearances before the Supreme Court. What's more, Cooper v. Harris is just one of several recent or current cases brought in state or federal court challenging aspects of North Carolina's redistricting. Because the Supreme Court found both District 1 and District 12 to be unconstitutional racial gerrymanders, North Carolina will have to go back to the drawing board and create a new redistricting plan before the 2018 congressional elections. And then the 2020 census will be right around the corner, requiring a new redistricting. So it seems unlikely that this is the last legal battle over North Carolina's election districts. Looking beyond North Carolina, it remains to be seen how much impact Cooper v. Harris will have. The unanimous decision on District 1 shows a court unwilling to give much leeway to legislators who cite potential Voting Rights Act liability to justify race-based districting. But only time will tell what effect this case will have on future redistricting or the lower court's evaluation of fact-intensive disputes over racial versus political motives. Before I wrap up this episode, I want to touch on one more issue. On hearing about these legal fights over partisan versus racial motivations in redistricting, you may have been surprised to learn that blatantly partisan gerrymandering is considered acceptable and is even invoked as a benign explanation of alleged wrongful conduct. The court has been reluctant to police partisan gerrymandering, in part because of the lack of any broadly accepted objective standard for impartial districting, or any clear line between acceptable districting choices and partisanship that goes too far. This hands-off approach is very controversial. Several cases currently in the lower courts cleanly present purely partisan gerrymandering claims, and many court watchers expect at least one of these cases to make its way up to the Supreme Court in the near future. So the court may soon have another chance to squarely confront the partisan gerrymandering issue. And that brings us to the end of Episode 8. Links to resources related to this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. We have more episodes planned and intend to keep bringing you new content through the summer, but we want to know what you want us to cover. If there's some case or legal topic or aspect of the court or the justices that you want to hear about, please let us know, and there's a very good chance we'll tackle it in a future episode. Your requests or feedback of any kind is very welcome. You can leave a comment on the show notes post at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at Counting to 5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. You can call and leave questions and comments on the Counting to 5 voicemail line at 774-226-8685. That's 774-2-COUNT-5. I look forward to hearing from you. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Counting to 5 to make sure you don't miss future episodes. If Counting to 5 is not available in your podcast app of choice, please let us know and we'll do what we can to get it listed. Please help spread the word about Counting to 5, and if you value what we're doing, please consider supporting this podcast financially. Visit Counting to 5's Patreon page where you can pledge as little as $1 a month. Every little bit helps. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to 5.